Welcome to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
My name is Jill.
And my name is Michael.
Catch us every other Wednesday talking about books, publishing, indie bookstores, chatting with authors, and so much more.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Book It Pod for more Book It content.
Want to read something you heard about on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/BookItPod.
Today's episode contains dialogue around and about gun violence and school shootings in America. The conversations are done delicately and with respect, but please be advised.
Hey, Michael.
I almost said good morning. It's not morning. Hello, Jill.
How are you?
You know what?
What?
I'm great.
Excellent.
Yeah, how are you?
Well, I have hit the epitome of procrastination this morning. My children went to school for the second time in 2 weeks because of the weather.
Oh.
And when I woke up this morning, my brain said, great, you can finally get done the 37 things on your to-do list. And instead of doing those, I started running, but I'm out of procrastination items. So for some reason, my brain went to what is quite possibly the worst procrastination task on earth.
Exactly.
Doing my taxes.
What? Like, I do, like, people procrastinate doing their taxes.
Right. Why was my brain like, you know, you really don't need clean underwear. You know what you should do? Send the IRS the money.
Wow. I mean, like, honestly, this, I have to say, like, this is a coded cry for help, please. Podcast help listeners, me. Like, check on us.
I'm not okay. Yeah, I don't know. Nobody's going to have any socks tomorrow, but
that's okay.
My
Whatever.
Taxes will be done before the deadline. I can't explain it. You're right. It's a cry for help. I just don't know what I need help on.
There's no things. Solution. There's no answer. There's no way to help us, but we need help.
Yes. Yeah. What are we talking about today?
Well, today is such an exciting episode because we had the unbelievable pleasure of getting to interview Jasmine Warga for her newest book, The Shape of Thunder. And you guys will hear it in a second, but the book itself is so good. But part of what makes it so good is that it is an unbelievably difficult subject matter, especially with regards to the age that it's catered to. Mm-hmm. And she wrote it with so much empathy that I was honestly a little bit nervous to read it once I realized what it was about. Yeah. And then getting into reading it, it just was so beautiful and also incredibly heartbreaking.
Yes. It's all of those things. I was also really excited to read it because we love Jasmine's work so much. When we got her first book, Other Words for Home, in at the store, I took a copy home and they were teasing me. I was like a pusher. Yeah. I was like, you guys, you have to read this book. And it had been a while, the last several years, for any of the kind of Newbery books. It was like, oh, yes, I read and enjoyed that one. Or, oh, I really liked that one and I've been recommending it.
Yeah.
But this was a book that I would say I was like over the moon for and actively campaigning and pushing for and wanting other people to read right from the start. And so it was really fun then when it was recognized and,
totally.
And it was like, oh yes, other people love it the way that I love it. And Jasmine has been such a huge supporter of the Blue Manatee and she came by the store and did signed copies for us and has been so nice and generous. And so when I heard she had a new book coming out, I was immediately like, I got to get my hands on it.
Yeah.
And she was so kind and thoughtful and generous in sending us books and agreeing to chat with us. And the interview was as fun and enlightening as my expectations were.
So exactly.
I'm excited for everybody to hear it.
Me too. And to your point about, that's a good point about, I too have had that experience when I've read a Newbery book or any book that's won whatever award and been like, okay, yeah, like that was good. Congrats. But there are very few times where I'm just like, I can't describe enough just like how much it deserved it.
Yes.
And that is exactly how Other Words for Home felt. It was just like, if this doesn't win, like, we need to stop this award ceremony altogether because it's so good.
Yeah.
And kind of in the same way that when we picked Nancy Johnson for our first book club selection, which was like months before anyone was talking about it yet. I mean, like, within the book industry they were, but like, readers weren't getting it, reviews weren't out yet. And then the closer and closer it got to publication, it was just getting so much praise and acclaim, and readers were really responding to it. And it just felt like thankful. I was so thankful because I was like, okay, yes, like we agree with you deeply.
Yes.
And I like The Shape of Thunder for the fact that it's very different.
It is.
From her other work. And it posed, I think, a challenge for her. But I think it doesn't feel that way in reading it. She writes just as naturally as she ever does.
I agree.
So I'm excited. This is a really fun interview. And let's get into it. Today's episode is sponsored by the podcast Why Are You Like This, hosted by Jamie Ryan and Austin Williams, which is perfect because it's a weekly podcast that handles really difficult, complicated, everyday problems in a really safe space that feels so approachable. They've been described as a lightweight anthropology lecture and a comedy show all in one, and I totally agree. I've been a listener for years, and I had the pleasure, actually, of being a guest co-host several years ago, and Jamie and Austin welcomed me and my perspective with so much respect, and we laughed so much, and we learned so much from one another, and it was just such an amazing time. You really should go check them out. Why Are You Like This is available across podcast platforms. You can also follow them on Instagram at Why You Like This Pod, and head to their website at whyareyoulikethispod.com.
We are joined today by Jasmine Warga. Jasmine is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Other Words for Home. Other Words for Home earned multiple awards, including a John Newbery Honor, a Walter Honor for Young Readers, and a Charlotte Huck Honor. She is also the author of young adult books, My Heart and Other Black Holes, and Here We Are Now, which have been translated into over 20 different languages. The Shape of Thunder, spoiler alert, you're going to love it. Her next novel for middle grade readers will be published in May 2021. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi.
We are so excited to have you here today. I have to share with you really quickly, when I finished the book, Michael and I were working on the prep for this episode, and I have a lovely relationship with my older kids' ELA teacher. And I emailed her and I said, can I please send you a book? because I need you to read it. I want your take on it. I really, really loved it. It's by Jasmine Warga. And I like sent her a little synopsis, and she emailed me back immediately in like all caps and was like, I love Jasmine Warga.
Yeah.
Please send me this book. So I sent it this morning with my kids in their backpack, and I have already received an email back from her. And I'm going to embarrass you. The subject line says hooked, page one. And she said, I had a down moment while the kids were all independently working, and I read the author's note and page one. I now know what my evening is going to look like. I can't wait.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you. You made my day already. We're all into this, so thank you.
I loved it because it was so similar to Michael and I both, like, immediately were hooked on this book.
Oh, thank you. It's such a odd thing sometimes to write books about these difficult subjects because you want to be honest and not exploitive and things like that, but you also are in the business of telling stories. And there's something about wanting to make it a story that moves and intrigues the reader enough to engage with that subject matter, right? And that's always like the balance that I'm looking for. And so to hear that the book has like hooked readers and was a story that they were able to engage with is like the most important thing and like really fulfilling for me to hear, because that's something I think about a lot, how you can write challenging books that end up feeling like empowering to readers.
Yeah.
And so that, I really appreciate that. And that's so nice. Thank you so much for sharing that, Jill.
One of the things that I loved discovering about you when I finished Other Words for Home is that while you currently live in Chicago, Cincinnati is your hometown.
Yes.
And we've been on a bit of a kick lately in talking with authors who just happen to live in the Midwest. And I'm curious if you feel like our sometimes overlooked space here in the middle of the country impacts how you approach your storytelling or how your characters view things.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was born and raised in Cincinnati and definitely feel like Ohio is home.
Yeah.
And I do think that lots of times in stories, coastal stories tend to be more of the focus. And just as a country, we kind of forget about this large swath until everyone rediscovers it during election years. And then
right.
I also get really frustrated by the way Ohio in general is painted, because the Cincinnati that I grew up in, while deeply flawed in lots of ways, also was not this caricature mm-hmm. of Ohio in the way that it sometimes is painted. And so I think that there's also, I don't know if it's a laziness or a comfort, we'll say comfort because that sounds better, that I tend to position my stories in the Midwest because that's what I know. But I think that it's important to me to continue to push and change, I think, people's idea of what the Midwest is. I remember in my debut year, another author discovered that I was from Cincinnati. And she's like, oh, yeah, I know someone else who's from Ohio. And like thinking that the state has like four people. And so like, you'd all meet at the general store. You know, like, I there is sometimes just a... I like all things that you love, you can see them sort of for what they are. And I think I want Ohio to be better than it is sometimes, but
yeah.
I also love mm-hmm. it enough to want that for
of
it.
Of course, yes. So.
Yeah, I love that juxtaposition. Yeah, I love it here, but I want more for it and for it to improve.
Right. It's like, is it that James Baldwin quote where he says like, to love America, you have to want her to be better or something. Like it's how I feel about Cincinnati too. It's like all of the stories are people who like, if it's about the Midwest, it's people who used to live in really like sexy places. And then like their families uproot them to this like terrible town in Ohio. But it's like, that's not all that we have to offer here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love getting to show off Cincinnati whenever
Right.
friends will come from out of town, like to Books by the Banks, and they're always kind of wowed by, you know, the food scene or even like the architecture that we have. I think it surprises them. And so I like to be able to play with that.
Yeah. Your author's note at the beginning of the book really moved me. I was off to the races right away. And I made my husband read it too. And we were both just like glossy eyed and emotional. And I think it does such a great job of not just preparing the readers for what they should expect, but also talking to the adults and the parents about why it's so important. I'm just curious, like, when did the author's note happen for you? Was it upon reflection? Or did you always know you wanted to start the book with a message directly from you to the reader?
The author's note that's in the advanced reader copy, a version of that will now be in the back of the book in the finished copy. But I always knew that I wanted a chance to talk about why I wanted to tackle this subject, particularly for this age group, because I think that you see not a ton, but you definitely see gun violence tackled more in what publishing calls young adult, which are books geared more towards teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have realized is so many of our younger kids, especially our tweens, are aware of this issue. They're carrying this anxiety. They're doing these drills. And I wanted a way to kind of break open that conversation. And so when I was thinking about how I wanted to write this book or why I did, I went back to myself as a young reader, which I think is sort of where the author's note starts, of thinking about why I turned to books as a young person. Often I did for those things that were really difficult to talk about and talk about with the grownups in my life. And my hope is that this book can kind of act as that bridge, that sometimes it's easier for us to talk about these difficult things in the form of story, because that gives us kind of this vocabulary from which to start. And so I actually wrote the author's note. It had been, I guess, rolling around in my head for a long time while writing the book.
Yeah.
But I didn't sit down to write it until July of this year, right before the ARC was going to go to print. And I was thinking a lot about all of the different things that collided into this book. In lots of ways, this is my most like plot ambitious book. And so it's a difficult book to talk about because it obviously has this central issue, but and also has this big time travel piece that I lived with and is also sort of thematic to how I think of the book, which is a book about sort of the power of imagination, which is something that young people are so great at, and this unwillingness to accept things the way they are, again, wanting things to change, and the power in the that kind of belief. And so, I guess that sort of roundabout way of saying that that letter was always there with me. Those were things that I thought about while working on the book, and then kind of was given the opportunity to distill down to put at the beginning.
When I started reading this, I knew that the subject matter was going to hit home. I have 2 sixth graders and 2 third graders. And I had, timing is so weird.
Yeah.
I had read, the first 2 chapters, and the kids came home from school and I said, "Hi, how was school today?" And they were like, "Oh, it's fine. We had an active shooter drill." Like, it was a Tuesday.
Yeah. Their normal day.
And I just became so emotional thinking about how long this had been a part of their lives and how I have so much anger and frustration at how normal this is for them. And what I found so helpful in The Shape of Thunder was that this very emotional subject matter is presented in ways that children will understand because they are living it. But as adults, I think it's important for us to have the kids' perspective, because sometimes it just offers us a window into their reality. And I've seen this arc of, in first grade, the kids would be like, "Well, why would someone come into our school?" And now it's like, it was Tuesday, we had an active shooter drill. And I'm just curious how you approached the tone, because it is, at no point did I feel overwhelmed, and it felt like it was compassionate and empathetic and really at this great access point so that kids and adults could engage with it.
Yeah, thank you. That's, that's always the kind of, just to back it up, I guess, to a wider lens, sort of the, I think the most difficult thing about writing for young people is that you have to hold sort of 2 different things in each of your hands. One is that young people are as complex and interesting as grown-ups. So just something that I think grown-ups often forget about, their ability to think about difficult things and hard things and tough topics, and these are a part of their life. While also honoring that viewpoint of a young person. Like, I don't want to write a book from a grown-up perspective and just tell you that my character is 12 years old and espouses exactly what I think about this topic. And so I think that for me, it was digging back deep into, again, that those sort of quintessential qualities that young people have of this like imaginative ability, of this, wide and big hearts, and just sort of honoring what it means to be 12, but also what it means to be 12 in America today. And I think that that is hard. And I think it's also, it's definitely a balancing act. And I'm glad that the book felt, it's such a balancing act between wanting it to feel gentle enough that it has love and hope for its readers. Like, I don't want to, like I said, I want to write challenging books that feel empowering to the readers after they're done reading them. And so it definitely is. I think that it is just getting back in touch with my 12-year-old self. And also, this book was informed. So I had been working on this book for a long time, and a lot of the drafting of this book was done before the pandemic hit, or at least a lot of storming, and I was on a pretty heavy school visit circuit. And so I was getting to talk with young people all the time and really see, you know, kind of how they felt about the world. And I was just always blown away at every school visit by how many of our schools now are designed around this issue. And it just broke my heart that like that has been our grown-up solution to the problem, is to like turn schools into fortresses. And for me to come to the author visit, I have to, you know, provide like three different forms of ID and buzz in and go here and then here. And I understand why that is. And obviously I want everyone to stay safe, but it just like really brought home for me again how this is something that's really present, like you said, in all of their lives. They definitely, it's not, I don't think that there's any 10 or 11 year old or 12 year old who's going to pick up this book and this is going to be the first time they've ever thought gun violence.
Yeah, not at all.
Well, and I'm going to say, I don't really have a question here, it's just more praise. To go off of that, The Shape of Thunder just brought home for me what you said about how what it's like to be a 12-year-old in America today. That's so true, because growing up, I never once had an active shooter drill, and it never even crossed the minds of my generation. And I think I was in high school when the Virginia Tech shooting happened, and we were so aware of that incident. It made national news, but it still felt like something that couldn't touch us. And something that I found interesting in The Shape of Thunder was the conversation around how this incident didn't receive the same national attention as others did. And it sort of made those involved kind of feel alone in it, as if less lives lost was any less tragic.
Yeah. I think I was in fifth grade when Columbine happened and how much that gripped national attention. I was aware of it, but it's like what you're saying about the Virginia Tech shooting. When that happened, we all thought this was a one-off. This is something that wouldn't happen here. And just, but that was sort of, at least in my memory, the first one where we had like national live media.
Right. Oh, that's true.
And now there's so many of them that it's no longer shocking. And that to me is the most heartbreaking thing, that the ones that really now make extended media coverage are the ones where there's a higher death count. And that, again, it's just so sad. And I, and just how common it is, at least, I mean, you know, pre-pandemic, to hear of these mass shootings in a mall and a movie theater, and this constant anxiety of it could happen anywhere. And I'm not exactly sure for me when that turning point happened of viewing the world like that, but it definitely has gotten there, that it's like no place feels safe anymore. And so I definitely wanted, to write about that, because again, it's this idea of, I think that it's a problem and an issue that's worth interrogating, even when it's not one of these sensationalized events that really captures national attention. And something actually I do want to bring up, that I talk a little bit about in the new author's note that's in the back of the book, is also the idea that communities like Cora and Quinn's, which are, you know, affluent middle class communities, oftentimes receive more national attention and media sympathy than other communities. And I think that's also a problem and a discussion that is worth having about why we view gun violence to be shocking in certain communities and not other communities, and how this is an issue that affects all of our kids. And I want there to be a broader solution for all of them.
Yeah. One of the aspects of the book that Jill and I kept returning to was the low-key racism. Cora deals with at school and perhaps played a role in her sister's death. And because Cora experiences personally, she notices that happening to her friends too, like Owen. And I loved that little crush she had on Owen. I thought it was so sweet. And it also makes her reflect on how little she knows about her father's heritage and traditions. Between this and Other Words for Home, what have readers' responses been to you to this, if there has been one?
Yeah, so I'm really excited for The Shape of Thunder to come out for this reason, that I feel like it's going to show just a different facet of the Muslim Arab experience in the U.S. Cora's understanding of her background in lots of ways is more similar to mine when I was in middle school. I guess I'm somewhere like more, I guess, in the middle between her and Jude, and that I did have a little bit more of a sense and knowledge of mm-hmm. my background and my family's religious traditions. But just this idea I wanted to show, because I see this so much in the community of a lot of parents, they feel really protective of their kids and they want their kids to feel American. And in doing that, they don't teach them about their culture. And definitely like this idea where Cora talks about how people always ask her and Owen where they're from, but they never ask her white friend Mia. That's completely drawn from my own childhood experience,
right.
Where when I went to, for listeners who are from Cincinnati, from kindergarten to eighth grade, I lived in Wyoming, Ohio.
Oh my gosh. I lived in Finneytown.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Same area. So,
yeah.
at my elementary school, I'm pretty sure that I was the only kid who had an immigrant parent in my class. And I remember so much being asked those types of questions, like, where are you from? What are you? And when I was little, it's not so much that it bothered me, but what bothered me was that my friends were never asked that question. And I felt like I'm from Wyoming. And so I definitely like wanted to tackle that. And I wanted to tackle in Cora's perspective when she talks a lot about how she's wondering a lot about why Quinn's brother Parker did this terrible thing. But the fact that that kind of wondering is only afforded to a certain kind of perpetrator sometimes in the U.S., that I think there's a large frustration on the part of other communities about how sometimes that questioning isn't asked. It's just assumed because of these identity markers, which is obviously so problematic. And so I definitely like wanted to weave that in there. It's not, I think it's less a book about identity than Other Words for Home is, but that definitely plays a part in Cora's whole process, because how could it not? That a lot of Cora's wondering if she's enough of this one thing or the other, that's very much drawn from my own experience. And I still feel that, actually, to really answer your question when you were asking about the feedback, I am always in awe of the feedback that Other Words for Home has gotten, and I'm so touched whenever Muslim kids will write to me and say, you know, this is the first time I saw someone like myself on a book cover or read about a family like mine. But I also always worry about feeling like I'm enough of this or, you know, have the right to write that kind of story. Because I think for those of us who are kind of in that like double bind of feeling too much this and too much that, it can be really isolating. And so I kind of wanted to capture that for Cora and how she kind of lost her person who also felt that way in her sister.
I'm so glad that you mentioned Mabel, because one of the other things that I really loved about this book was that even though we know from the start Mabel has passed, you still get a really beautiful sense of their sister relationship. And I loved the aspects of it where, you know, she idolizes her older sister and we know all the good and wonderful things about Mabel. But as she starts to heal and come to realizations, you know, it's also like, and also my sister is annoying.
Yeah.
I don't know. As a person who has a sister, I just felt like it was just so well done, where you're just sort of always equal parts. I love this person and they're amazing, but man, they drive me crazy.
Well, but because I totally agree, mainly because it feels like, I mean, I think naturally grief makes us idolize aspects of the person we're grieving, and then it can end up feeling kind of empty, because we want to remember them as the fully formed people that they were. And so her point, Jasmine, tell me if I'm wrong, but she wants to remember her sister in her entirety, you know, like,
yeah, no, that's exactly the point. I think that in grief, lots of times we have a tendency to kind of sanctify people and martyrize them. And that's not your loved one. Your loved one is complicated and you love them in spite of and because of those complications. And I think that's what Cora finds frustrating, that this idea that suddenly her sister needs to be kind of scrubbed of all of her hard edges and how they remember her. And that makes her feel like she's losing her sister even more because her memory feel unreliable. And I think that's a really big part of grief. I mean, I think about that with people that I've lost, of how I want to make sure that I'm remembering them in all of their complexity and not just kind of the highlight reel, which is obviously the impulse when somebody passes.
I also really loved so many of the lighthearted moments in this book. One of my favorites that I had marked was when Cora describes being around Owen and she says she has a shaken up soda can feeling in her stomach. And when Quinn talks about how the, you know, the super cozy sweatshirt is one of the best parts of being on soccer team. I just felt like it did such a great job of capturing the tween eye on things. So I'm so curious, are you hanging out with tweens? What inspires their dialogue? How did you get in their heads?
I think I'm just very in touch with myself at 11, 12, 13, because those were the hardest years of my life, truly. Yeah. And there's like, I guess, psychology that says that whatever was like your most challenging time period, and lots of times some small part of you is stuck there. And I think some small part of me is stuck reliving like 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And I remember how proud I was of my volleyball team sweatshirt and how long I held onto it because of this. It symbolized for me like something bigger than myself, this idea that I belonged somewhere, and wearing that felt like such like a shield and comfort. And then the soda can thing is just something I have always had like an affinity for drama and language. Remember thinking about like my own crush in middle school, trying to figure out what was going on with my body. Because a lot of times, this is the first time you're experiencing that. And I remember the first time I felt really weird around a boy that I had a crush on. I didn't know what was happening. You know, I didn't know why. And I didn't know, and I think Cora talks about this in the book, like if it felt good or bad, because it felt so weird and strange and I was afraid of it. And so I, like I said, I really want to capture those moments. I want the book to feel like tweens who are going through this, not, you know, my adult thesis about this issue in America. And so I think that it is like trying to be a testament to kids that things can be really, really tough. And at the same point, you're going to notice when that person is cute. Like I remember, this is maybe inappropriate to share, but this is kind of what I was thinking about, being at a funeral when I was in junior high and just being obsessed with my crush was like sitting behind me. And all I could think about was whether like I had combed the back of my hair, and then freaking out about how that was such an inappropriate thought to be having at this moment.
Oh, a teen spiral.
Yeah. And so I wanted to like give, you know, testimony to that. I think that you can like have a lot going on and also still be worried about all of the other sort of, I guess, normal trappings of adolescence and freaking out about whether you have food in your braces at the funeral. There's like lots of dissociative thoughts, I guess.
If you were going to tell an embarrassing story about your middle school years anywhere, this podcast is the place.
Yeah, 100%.
Michael and I just like have a whole thing going where we embarrass ourselves on a regular basis.
I love that. Especially, you know what? I mean, this is kind of a digression, but I don't know if, has anyone watched Pen 15 here?
No.
It reminds me of this kind of conversation because it's like the concept is like these two 30-year-old adults are playing 13-year-olds and the rest of the cast are actual 13-year-olds.
Oh, amazing.
And it's so funny, but it's sold sort of comedically, but why I watch it is because it makes me feel validated in the things that felt like a big deal when I was a kid. And I get really emotional watching it. And I think it's why I got so, I just thought about this now. I think it's why I got so emotional reading The Shape of Thunder, was because it didn't, those moments, those tiny moments, those like micro kid moments, in this macro situation, which is gun violence, felt really validating. Like, yeah, I also, in the closet, felt really weird about people I had crushes on and like super didn't know how to navigate those feelings.
Yeah, and those feelings don't go away just because another big thing is happening. And
exactly.
I think that's what is like sometimes hard to remember as an adult, because I feel like we train ourselves more to be like, this is the emotion I'm supposed to have in this situation. And I think kids, it's more befuddling, like, to, and your emotions just can feel so much larger and sort of like out of control, just something Cora really struggles with, because obviously she doesn't like to feel at all like out of control or not understanding what's going on. So
I'm just kind of piecing this together now, but I was really struck kind of the juxtaposition, because one minute you're at school and you're being a regular kid, and then the next minute, you know, Cora says, ever since Mabel died, I spend time keeping track of where everybody is and making sure that everybody's safe, because I've learned that no one is safe. And you're just like, oh, yes, you're 12 and you're obsessed with a boy and your hair and also death.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's the COVID generation is amazing, and they deserve better.
Period. And that's all we have for you today. there's this one quote that I really loved. I really loved how Cora was all facts and numbers, and that Quinn found comfort in Cora sharing new information with her. I also loved their secret little language, where if Quinn was freezing up, Cora knew exactly if she needed help or if she just needed a second. In this era of their friendship being really non-existent, they still respected that. And all this just felt like love to me, this deep friendship love that they each individually have, and get to a point where they're considering forgiveness. And Quinn puts it so lovely. She says, "How do you draw forgiveness? I imagine sketching it. Aloe lotion on a sunburn, a grilled cheese on a snowy day, a soft sweatshirt that feels like a second skin." I have chills. That is so wise and so filled with love. And that's all I have to say. I don't have a question. I was really moved by their budding friendship when they're trying so hard to keep things apart.
Thank you. It definitely, that was what I was going for. I mean, they're two very different girls, and that Cora sort of thinks in numbers and facts, and Quinn, obviously, she thinks in images and is a little bit dreamier. But how much they need one another and learn from one another. And I think that's kind of what friendship is. And sometimes, I think lots of times, sort of, when you're a little kid, who your best friend is can sometimes be as random as like who was also at the like home living station with you in preschool, or you know, had the same last name as you in kindergarten. And then you both start to grow into your own people. And sometimes those people are very different. And that's how it was for my best friend from elementary school to middle school. But I loved her and I love her still, even though we're very different people. And what I've come to realize is that being with her sort of helps me to like access those things, her strengths, and also recognize like the strengths in myself. And I think that sometimes is like the really difficult part of adolescent friendships, though, because you can sometimes like fall into this trap in fifth or sixth grade where you feel like your friend has to be someone who's the exact same as you and has the exact same interests as you, because this fear of being different in any way is really scary at that age. And so that, I thought about that a lot, and how like they both can feel insecure around the other. Like, I think that's very clear in Quinn, because she's not well suited to kind of the traditional school system of sort of rote memorization, and feels that she's not intelligent, even though she obviously is, just in a way that isn't showing up so much in our world of kind of standardized tests and et cetera. And Cora, I think, feels a little bit nervous that Quinn is a little bit more just like chill in lots of ways. And so maybe does like better in like a larger social situation, also definitely prior to the tragedy happening. But I appreciate that. This was my first book where I had to write from two different perspectives. And so that was definitely like a challenge for me to get into it. But I think that what I did was I buried different parts of me in each of them, which made it like easier to keep them straight.
One of the things that I think is so amazing about middle grade fiction, and I think sometimes adults miss out when they stop reading it, is that you can have magical elements. Like obviously Quinn and Cora decide the way to solve this problem is time travel.
Right. Which I loved.
Right. And in an adult book, you would just be like, either it's fantasy because we're time traveling, or there's no time travel and it's realistic fiction. And middle grade lives in this magical middle place where, I mean, I wanted these girls, even though I knew, like, we're not in the book where they're going to do, I wanted them to.
That's childhood.
Yes. And that was just one of the aspects about this that I love. But I'm curious, like, where did the time travel aspect come from for you? And is it a personal interest? I don't know.
Or is it one now?
Yeah,
well, definitely. Yeah, both. I think that it was funny because I first started thinking about the book, which I mentioned in that author's note, the day I saw an active shooter drill happening at a school that was really close by to the apartment my family was living in Chicago. And I was thinking about how really soon my oldest daughter would go to school and I wouldn't have to talk to her about why they had active shooter drills. And I didn't really know what I would say. But I just had this like feeling of wanting to write a book about it, but not having a story. And again, there's like this idea that you can't just like write a polemic essay, right? Like you can have feelings about a topic, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have a story. And so I had to wait for the story to come. And it sort of came to me all as a rush, really serendipitously, almost in the way Quinn talks about like just clicking on random things on the internet.
Okay.
I was sort of doing that one day and found this article buried way down low about this scientist from MIT who was talking about the physics of time travel and how it's actually a possible thing, like philosophically in science. And I like used to think I didn't like science, and now I've like rediscovered that I love like really heavy philosophical science. Yeah. Where they talk about like how like particles change from being observed. And I think that that's just fascinating that like there's an argument to be made that like our universe only exists because like we are viewing it, and like those kind of concepts. And so I just sort of was like, wow, what if these two girls have experienced this massive trauma and they want to time travel in order to stop it? Because I got back to thinking about like the responsibility that I saw on these kids' face who were doing the drill. And I was thinking about like how they feel this need to fix this thing that they shouldn't have to fix. And so it all kind of just snowballed from there. And it definitely now is, because I was reading, I was kind of doing the research with Quinn and Cora in order to be able to write the book. Cause I was like, okay, well, how would they do it? Like they probably wouldn't be able to build a time machine. So they probably want like a wormhole. And what does that mean? And like reading all of these threads. And so it definitely is. I think that I've always been like a portal fantasy person, which might be like really surprising given the types of books that I've written so far. But I loved them as a kid. Like I was convinced that like any moment I was going to like turn the corner and there was just going to be like a gateway into another world. And so I think that that also like I kind of wove that this form of time travel has like a portal fantasy element to it. But I think that you're right. Like everything you're saying about kids and their ability to believe in magic. And I think that that's also kind of what pushes us forward, because science feels like magic. You know, right now, time travel, we would put it in like a science fiction magic quantity, but probably about 300 years ago, we would have said flying is the same way, you know? Yeah. So I was thinking a lot about that, because I was like, okay, I have to pick something though that works for Cora, because she's a little bit more hard-edged in the ability to like believe in that type of stuff. And so I wanted to kind of play with that and also play with this idea, like thematically of progress, right? That things mm-hmm. that seem impossible only seem impossible until they become possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of how I feel about like fixing things too.
I have a question. I was looking at Joe. I wanted to make sure I was allowed to go. There's a conversation in this book to be had about toxic masculinity and male rage. And that is another aspect of this book that I think is handled so delicately and with a lot of patience and understanding of who is going to read this. How did you come to those aspects of the book and getting to writing them?
Yeah, so 100% they're there. I think that if you're going to write a book about gun violence in America, it's impossible to not in some way touch on toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Obviously, the problem of gun violence is so multi-pronged. And so I'm not at all saying that just this one thing, you solve this one thing, you solve it. I think the fact that it's so multi-pronged is why as a society, we've buckled under its complexity, because it's like if you try to bring up one, someone will say no X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So I want to be really careful here that even though I'm talking about X, I'm not saying that we don't also need to address Y and Z.
But absolutely.
I think that we have a major mental health crisis in our country, especially for young people, and it's something really near and dear to my heart, wanting to have better care and a more open discussion about that as someone who suffers from mental illness and loves people who suffer from mental illness. But I think that particularly in writing this book, I was researching, especially with young boys, and how consciously or unconsciously from a very young age, lots of boys are raised to, not show their emotions, not cry, et cetera, and to be tough. And then later on, when they start to fall and struggle with mental health issues, they fall back on this idea of they need to be tough. And how are they supposed to be tough? Well, lots of times that's linked, again, consciously or unconsciously, to violence. And we see this pattern again and again, that that's a way to show strength, to like not be a victim. And so I think that while the people and kids who have committed these crimes, it's absolutely unexcusable what they did. Like, I'm not making excuses. Sure. But I also think this is the time that we need to have some kind of radical empathy and understand these are kids. And why are kids doing this? What are they falling back on? And how have we failed these kids? And again, getting back to what I said earlier, kind of in our conversation about how I think certain types of kids are afforded more empathy than other kinds of kids. And that's also a really big issue, that if a Muslim teen commits a crime, it's because they're Muslim. But if a white boy commits a crime, it's a mental health issue. And I recognize the frustration in that, but it also doesn't make it not a mental health issue. Like, there is a mental health component here of this toxic environment that we're raising our kids in. And I really wanted to talk about that and talk about the ways in which Quinn's parents are obviously flawed, but they're not. I didn't want to make them the caricature flawed parents. I wanted to show how really they're well-meaning. You know what I mean? They didn't. Yeah. Obviously, there's no universe in which they wanted their son to do this, or they wouldn't have wanted to help their son, but they didn't understand and know. And I think that we have this culture because we don't talk about these tricky things with our kids. And we don't talk about, especially with our boys, that it's okay if you feel not okay. And this is like something that lots of people are going through, and kind of giving them these tools and support system. And so I definitely wanted that to be in the book. But you're right. Like, I wanted to proceed with a gentle hand for lots of reasons. One, it's really important for me for the book to not feel didactic. Like, I want to write books that ask questions, but not give answers. So it's asking the question of like, what went wrong with Parker? Why do we think he was in this position? Was there a chance in which he could have been stopped? Like, and these aren't things I even know really the answer to, just like questions the book was raising, because I hope that in raising those questions, we can open up that conversation. about, you know, toxic masculinity and how disaffected so many kids feel today. And again, it's like, I think that it's a hard conversation to have because there's so many double standards and so many layers of privilege. And so I understand why it's hard. Yeah. That's where it gets back to this idea of like radical empathy of, I think that even though we can feel really frustrated and want to fix other systems, that doesn't mean that there isn't something that's broken in this one.
Yeah. As I was reading, I was going with the expectation that we're going to figure it out, you know, like we're going to piece together, as we piece the story together, we're going to find out what snapped in Parker, why this happened.
Yeah, the big why.
But I at the end, I like that that remains unanswered.
Yeah.
Because it's just so much more true. I mean, our local school system here was just shocked, racked to its knees a couple years ago. Within like a 90-day period, 3 kids at our high school committed suicide. And you just look at like what is going on in our culture. And even though everyone was very upset and like, we need to take action, again, these are big problems and they don't have easy answers. And I just love that it was handled with empathy and compassion, but also realistic of, we don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's so messy, right? And that's what I wanted to show of, I think there's lots of, we can have ideas about what was going on with him, about why certain kids are more likely to be able to become like radicalized on the internet and things like that, why they're more susceptible to that. There's an alienation, there's a mental health piece, but it's still messy. Like, why do some move from the bedroom to actual action, some don't? And that's something that like, we don't know. And so I think that I wanted to resist kind of easy answers, and sort of the fiction that I admire the most does that. And so I'm always trying to resist that impulse, but it is hard because there's like part of you that also knows you're writing a story. And so you want certain pieces to be able to click. And so it's that, again, it's that balance of having it be messy, but hopefully in like a satisfying way.
In a realistic way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So our favorite question to ask when we can, other words from home, one, the Newbery Honor. We like to do a, where were you? What was it like?
Tell us everything. Make us.
We want all the details. Were you in your pajamas?
Just as I am right now.
Yes. So 100% I was in my pajamas. So like the night before ALA Awards, I was kind of jittery, which I was mad at myself for being jittery because I was like, you are so delusional. But the weird thing about, like, I think our current like really social media heavy culture is leading up to the ALA Awards, there's lots of like schools that do like mock Newbery Club, which is so sweet and great, but you're also just being relentlessly tagged in things. So you start to be like, what? Like, is that like even a possibility? Like, could that happen? And so, and you know, it's weird because like the Newbery is the one literary award that I knew what it was when I was a kid. So that made it like extra special and heightened to me because I remember like those stickers on books. And so again, so I was like jittery, but then I was like, you're like delusional. like just stop. And so, but I was like having trouble going to sleep. And then at like 2 a.m., I like had like this real time moment with myself where I was like, okay, like girl, like this is not happening. Like you just need to go to sleep, but it's going to be a great day tomorrow because I'd loved so many books in that year and had gotten to know a lot of the writers who had written them. So we'd been at like conferences together, spoken on panels together. And I was like, this is going to be great. You're going to wake up and you're going to get to see like who won, who's celebrating. This is going to be really exciting. So I was like in this deep sleep, but also the night before I had like asked my husband, I was like, is it like so presumptuous of me to like turn my ringer on? Cause like I never sleep with my ringer on. And I was like, I don't want to be like a self-involved weirdo. And he was like, what are you talking about? He was like, no, just like turn on your ringer. Like nobody's going to know that except for me. Like, what are you talking about? I was like, okay. But in doing it, I guess multiple times, I'd actually like turned it off. So
great.
What I remember is like Greg, who's my husband, like nudging me and it must have been like 5 a.m. in the morning, and I was like in a deep sleep because this is after the real talk when I like finally got myself to sleep, being like, your phone is ringing. And me thinking like, what is happening? And then looking at it and seeing that it said Philadelphia, which is where I knew ALA was happening. And like, I felt like I couldn't breathe. And I answered the phone because I was like, is this like a hallucination? And Christian Grady, was the chair of the committee, when she said the words like John Newberry, I think I screamed or something. I'm not exactly, like, I don't really remember. What I remember is just like crying and being like, I don't have anything smart to say. And them all being like, yeah, we're not looking for like an acceptance. They were very nice, but I just thought they were like, okay, like she's clearly like
waking up,
confused. Yeah. And so sweet. So then I got off the phone and I was like sitting there just like stunned and you know, hugged my husband, was crying. And then I was like, okay, I think I need to like tell my editor, but I don't want to wake her up if I'm like having like a hallucination. So I text her and my agent. I'm like, hey, like, I think that Other Words Are Home just got a Newbery honor, but I'm not like 100% sure. But like, and then my editor responded back immediately and was like, oh my God, we know. Like, and they FaceTime me. And so I'm like in my pajamas. I'm like, teary mess and in screaming. I like woke up my kids, so everyone's up early. And then I remember we just like watched the live stream, which is like what I do every year. Awesome. And it was so surreal. It was just, I still like can't quite believe that it happened. And I'm just like really, really grateful. Cause like I said, I knew what that was. I knew those stickers and those stickers never had like those books that had stickers. Never had like kids who came from a background like mine in them when I was in middle school. And so like seeing that sticker on, especially on Other Words for Home, just like it means the world to me because like the Newbery is like for like American children's literature. And something about that like makes me teary when I think about it, that it's saying like, this is an American story, you know, that and so, yeah, thanks for letting me ramble. I like feel like I'm like how I was on the like, insane phone call.
This is one of the best stories we've gotten.
Yes, it's going to eventually bite us and someone's going to be like, I was expecting it and it was fine. But every time we ask this question, I feel like the stories are amazing.
So individual and unique. Yeah. And I love that you so deeply thought you were hallucinating to the point of like reaching out to your editor, still thinking you were hallucinating.
Yeah, because like, you know, I didn't want to like call her at like 5:30 in the morning and then she'd be like, oh my God.
This you're asleep. Crazy.
Next level. and so anyway, I recently just at this ALA Awards, a friend of mine received one of these wonderful phone calls and she said she like also couldn't talk and she told the committee, we're in a relationship now.
They were like, amazing.
They're like, okay. And what she meant is like, you'll always be so important to me. Like, I can't believe you came up with this honor. She's like, yeah, I told them we're in a relationship now. I was like, great.
Unbelievable.
They loved it, so.
If I ever win something, that's what I'm going to say. Absolutely. That's amazing.
Yeah. Let us know who to give credit to, because I'm also feeling that. This has been one of the best conversations we've had on Book It. We were joined today by Jasmine Warga, author of the Newbery Honor book, Other Words for Home, and many other titles. We want to thank Jasmine and her team at Balzer & Bray for making today's interview possible. The Shape of Thunder is out May 11th and is available for pre-order at our bookshop affiliate link, and or you can get it at your favorite, we hope, indie bookstore. Thank you so much, Jasmine. This has been such a lovely conversation.
Well, thank you guys so much. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
I love Jasmine.
I love her. And that, like, when she talked about, like, growing up in Cincinnati, it's such a Cincinnati thing to, like, immediately want to be like, where did you grow up? And yes. I was trying so hard not to do that because I am born and raised and continue to live in Cincinnati. And then she welcomes the information, and where she grew up is like my neighborhood's neighbor. Like, we just, like, are right next to each other. So, like, hearing how close she was to me, like, I immediately pretended I grew up with her.
I love
old
that.
Old friends.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're besties now. That has to be one of the best I got a call about an award story
oh
that
gosh.
I've ever heard.
I can't that. And it also feels totally like something I would do.
Yes. Yes, it was super relatable.
Yeah, and just like, I don't know, she sounds like some, well, I would say like she is someone who is a writer because she's a reader, and you can tell that she just like loves books.
Yeah.
And I love talking to authors who I can tell it's still such a joy for them. Like it's mm-hmm. they do it because they like the act of reading and are actively thinking about the reader as they're writing. Like I can feel her like really caring about the reader mm-hmm. in her books and in how she talks about them.
Yeah. I hope she won't mind my sharing this. I should have asked first, but I don't think she'll mind. We were exchanging messages about the best time to set up our interview.
Yeah.
And she and her husband are splitting their childcare duties. So the first couple of things, we were finding a day where my children are on a hybrid schedule where my kids were at school and her husband was on kid watching duty. And we're both just like apologizing to one another. And it was one of those rare moments in this as a working parent where you're like, thank God somebody else is experiencing.
Yes.
You know, you feel like you're alone on this raft of like trying to make it all work. And I was like, right. Thank God there's somebody else out here.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And that like, she was so apologetic. And you're like, I promise Michael's not going to care. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, I have like the least, I do not worry about me. It's like me and my dog and my husband, like I'll make it work.
I'm thankful for it on a regular basis. I was like, he's so used to this. I can't even tell you.
So now that you've listened to the interview, you notice, you'll understand why we had a bit of a content warning. And I think that she has, we talked to it with her author's note, I think, is really lovely. Yeah. And also like really puts the adults in the hot seat where we should be. Yeah. And says like the children should not be the ones who have to fix this, and yet we're making them the ones who have to fix this.
I had such a mixed reaction. I was so glad that she said they were keeping it in the final copies. I was a little bit sad that it's going to the back. At the
end. Yeah.
I wanted to be like, no, like we need to be confronting people with this in your face right in the beginning.
Yeah.
But then I also wonder too whether like after you've read and processed the story, are you more likely to read it at the end? I don't know.
Especially because when you come to the end, it's such a, the way that she writes about it is so nuanced because at no point does it feel like she's taking advantage of this thing that's happening to write mm-hmm. a story. And she said that. She's like, I was so moved by what was going on, and I knew my children were going to be a certain age soon where they were going to have to deal with this.
Yeah.
I knew I had a story in me, but I couldn't just go and write it because I wanted to. I had to come to her. And I think that because it doesn't feel exploitative in any way, mm-hmm. there's a lot of kindness and patience within the writing style that I think that it works really well at the beginning for an arc because it's like, here we go, this is what you're reading. And it also
is a
lovely reminder for at the end of the story to be like, yeah, this was fiction, but it's based off of something that's happening. And I just found it really touching. But I also found we talked to her a little bit about the male rage within this story. And she brought up a lot of really good points about that and her and the delicate way she wants to talk about it in her work. And there's this stat somewhere that I think it's like when boys and girls cry the same amount until the age of like 5, and then boys start to learn that crying is bad. Yeah. And we start crying less than girls. And in a really quiet way, there's an element of that in this story where like something changes and there's no like clear answer or reason why that changes the perspective of one of the main boys in the story and why maybe why he does the things he does.
Yeah You and I talked about this a little bit after we spoke with Jasmine, and I don't know whether it's like, you know, brain fog that is 2020-21 or whether it's that toxic masculinity is just so pervasive. I didn't clock that aspect when we were having the discussion about it and you were like, oh yes, I so noticed this. And she was like, oh, I'm so glad. And I was like, oh. It was like the light bulb went off over my head. Like I completely missed it.
Oh.
But it was nice to go back. I was glad that we talked about it because it really clued me into something that I had missed. Yeah. And I am so curious as a reflection on myself why that is. But I thought she handled it really well. And I was so glad that you had asked her about it.
I'm good.
I also really liked that therapy is so normalized in this book. Without overly violating their privacy too much, various of my children have been in and out of therapy for various reasons. And we have found it as a family incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
And yet I know, because I talk about it somewhat, whereas the culture is kind of don't talk about it at all.
Yeah.
You weirdly become like the magnet for like people will text me and be like, I hear you know about kid therapy. And I'm like, yes.
I do indeed. Yeah.
So I loved seeing it normalized in the book. I think it says to kids that, hey, we all need help sometimes. And if you're struggling, this is what therapy looks like. And therapy is a totally great and wonderful thing. I love that the teacher encouraged it and was like, let's find someone for you to talk to. That aspect of it, I think, was incredibly helpful. A culture at large, I feel like we need to be more embracing of the challenges of mental health.
I agree. And I think it's especially important for children. And I liked the juxtaposition between one of these kids is in therapy and one of these kids wants to pee.
Yeah.
And the responses to those two things from the adults in their lives is very different. And it points to kind of what you're saying, like, talk about it more and normalize it, because if someone is saying, I want professional help, the answer shouldn't be, no, absolutely not. Like, we don't need to judge up these feelings.
Yeah.
And seeing how much it benefited Cora was really, really touching. And I also loved the teacher. That was really helpful to Quinn. It's interesting, too. We have interviewed a couple authors who've said their newest work, whatever it is a little bit different than the work they've done before. Like Jessica Strasser said that, and Jasmine Borges said that. I'm curious, like, how does this tie into, like, the Jasmine Borges cinematic universe for you? Like, where does it land? And how for you, in what ways is it most different?
I was honestly surprised that she felt like it was so different because for me, it was another nuanced, heartfelt tale that encouraged you to look at something from a different or new perspective. I mean, this one offered multiple perspectives, but for me, it was I was expecting high quality writing. I was expecting to be emotionally engaged. And I was expecting a complex story or narrative that wasn't going to just tie up in a neat bow at the end, but still leave me feeling satisfied. And it was all those things.
Totally. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I would say the same for Jessica Strasser. I mean, she has such a reputation for book club books, but and in a lot of ways, A Million Reasons Why will be a great book club book.
Oh, yeah.
But also more than that. I don't – you know what I mean.
Right. I think it's – I just love hearing authors say that because it feels like a clue into, like, their creative process, because it tells me, like, okay, writing this for you was really different.
Yeah, I think
it's different. And to me, that tells – that tells me, like, there's, like, a specific level of passion placed upon this because you're aware of how different it was for you to write. And I just love hearing that. It makes me feel like I'm like part of a club.
Yeah.
But I agree. Like when she said that, I was like, oh, like, I mean, it's just as good as your other stuff. Like, so just like killed it. Oh, I shouldn't say that. See, like she also said, like, so much in writing this, she realized, or no, in the book, this is a point in the book, like that the dad says something totally innocuous and then realizes it's a gun reference and
Yeah.
After reading it, I have noticed that more.
Glennon Doyle has been talking about this a lot lately. Her kids do a lot of soccer, and she's been really campaigning against dropping the term suicide drills.
Wow.
And I had honestly, it had just kind of gone in one ear and out the other for me until she started really shedding a light on it. I was like, oh, we have to stop saying that.
Right.
I continue to be thankful that there are more clued in people who are willing to give the rest of us a self-check.
Honestly. And you and I talk about this all the time. Language is so important to me and to you. I know it is. Like, saying exactly what I mean and is important because I never want to say something that's going to upset someone or hurt someone unintentionally. I liked that aspect of this book because it's a great example of middle grade books are not just for middle grade readers. Like, we read tons of middle grade and we see so much worth in them that we like actively ask the authors to be on this podcast because we love them so much. Like, as a full adult, pretending to be a full adult, I learned a lot from this book, especially because I don't have children.
Yeah, I want to just press this into the hands of definitely every parent I know, but really adults in general. I really, really, really hope that this becomes a book that kids and adults read together.
Together, yeah, for sure. And I think it will be.
Yeah, I hope so.
So anyway, Jasmine.
We love
XOXO.
You. Seriously.
And listener, we love you too, XOXO. Thanks for listening. This book, The Shape of Thunder, will be available on our bookshop link where all of our books are. And if you head over to Instagram at BookItPod, catch up with us. And we're always asking the book community tons of bookish questions. We're also taking book recs. We love you guys telling us what to read. Head over at Twitter at BookItPod.com as well, where we're a little bit more spicy. And yeah. That's all I have. Jill, thanks for reminding me to do my taxes at some point.
Absolutely. That's what I'm here for.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
Book It is available across podcast platforms.
Subscribe to never miss an episode, and don't forget to leave a review before you go.
We'd love to stay in touch. You can find us online at bookitpod.com or on Instagram and Twitter at bookitpod.
Want to read something you heard on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod.
Book It was created by hosts Jill Burkett-Ragasey and Michael Woodson, with sound design and production by Madeline Call at Honeysuckler.